Salam, salam aleikum. That's an equivalent to the Hebrew shalom. Peace, the peace of God be with you, or in this case, upon all of us. It's a standard Muslim greeting. It's Arabic, as most of you, I guess, figured out or thought. It's used throughout the world by Muslims, no matter what their linguistic or cultural background. It may be just about the only Arabic that many of them know. Maybe something like a skol or a gesundheit, even. It's something that comes automatically. Kula hafiz is another expression. This is Persian Urdu, and it means the same thing. It's a greeting that was common in Iran, in pre-partition India, in Pakistan, but significantly never popular in Bangladesh. Even though, as some of you know, Bangladesh had also been a part of India, but it's a part of South Asia where the Muslims, particularly the lower class, the ordinary Muslims, has always used Bengali and not Urdu. So their greeting would be either the Arabic Assalamu Alaikum or some Bengali equivalent. I have the feeling, though, that the Arabic formulation has tended to be the one that is coming to replace the more local expressions of God be with you. That's just another manifestation, I think, of what we so often hear about, but I think is often simplistically presented and misrepresented. The idea of resurgent Islam, or in some cases the expression pan-Islam or pan-Islamism. It's true there is a significant growing self-consciousness among Muslims, and in many ways a special kind of self-confidence which they may not have possessed before. In some ways, I think that that is a positive thing to the world, and in some ways, ways which we won't be able to examine thoroughly this afternoon, maybe a little bit more fully in the other two sessions, ways that present some special problems in connection with the theme that I used for this session. The children of Abraham are Muslims, our brothers and sisters. Muslims take religion seriously, no less seriously than the Christians, certainly, and their sectarian tensions and problems have historically and today been expressed as forcefully as they have among Christians, say among Lutheran even today. And their antagonisms toward non-Christians too have been pronounced. But I sometimes believe that a certain understanding of the Western world, of its own history, vis-a-vis the Muslims, has overemphasized those historical antagonisms. Muslims initiate all kinds of activities with a prayer. Invocations are to be found at the beginnings of books, at the beginning of a chapter, sometimes at the start of a section of a book. Prayer is common before a trip, when some important decisions are to be made. Prayer is often pronounced, not privately, but very publicly. Before classes, before seminars, and more and more, if you keep your eyes open, you will see in the United States Muslims praying in various places, whether public or private, so that they can meet the requirements of praying five times a day. it might be useful for you to tend to look toward the east. It might be more easy to discover them. But Muslims, like anybody else, are possible of some latitudinarianism, and if conditions make something impossible, you do it as best you can. So having said that Muslims take their religion seriously and prayer seriously, and having myself read more than once some Muslim express the idea, I can't quite understand these Christians, because I've lived among them and I don't see them pray very much. I tend to see them go to church on Sunday, and I often hear a prayer before some kind of a political meeting, a prayer breakfast, but I don't really see them praying very much throughout the day. See, from their point of view, since they do pray regularly 5 times a day, they sort of wonder, well, where are these Christians, also the children of Abraham, where are they praying? So let us bow our heads before the great God, merciful, Al-Rahim, the Knower, Khabir, Allah, source of all wisdom and understanding. Your blessings, please, on all of us here gathered, and also on all of your creatures, whatever their present tasks or doings. Remember that I've prepared all right, but keep me attuned to the group, to the little sort of ummah that now surrounds each one of us. Open my mouth and guide my tongue, not only to speak the truth, but to be both relevant and intelligible to all who may hear me, now or later. Open our ears so that we may hear, not just what we want to hear, but what we should hear. Help us to penetrate, to understand, even while we reject the stereotypes, the characterizations, the caricatures of Arabs and Muslims so easily and so frequently perpetrated in the mass media. And keep all that is important alive in our memories, with our minds open, and with our theme of gentle justice, guide us to questions so we may probe deeper and not rest on the surface. Bless us so that I, who presume to be ustad or teacher, never think that I have the final answers or an adequate reply. Bless all of us so that we all may here continue to question each other, because we are concerned, as children of Abraham, to know our family, so that we do know justice, so that we do act in truth. We ask all these things for thy glory, for thy announcement of all your creation. We ask all this, yes, all this, in your name, Al-Rahim, the most merciful. All together now. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Say again.
Allahu
Akbar. I think most of the time when we hear that today on some news clip or we read it in the newspaper, we see it in the context of militant Muslims, say maybe the Shiites from Iran, attacking fellow Muslims in Iraq. And in such a context, it seems like they're saying, you know, God be on our side. It's a kind of a war cry. But like many invocations of a God, the circumstances and the intention is what is important, and not the words themselves. That expression tells us that God is great. And it emphasizes that we are the creatures of God, and the language of Western theology or philosophy, it wants to emphasize that God is transcendent, that he's the other, and that we are the creatures. Now, I haven't intended any of this to be cute, nor certainly I don't intend it to be condescending to Islam or to Muslims. to some degree, it's kind of a reconstruction of what might take place in what's called a madrasa, or a school for the teaching of religion. It's true that I did think of the possibility of us taking off our shoes and sitting on the floor, but then that's a hard thing to figure out. Whether that really is essentially religious, or whether that is cultural, or whether it's cultural and has been transformed into the religious. The symbolism is very important. The taking off of the shoes certainly is extremely important. It's a kind of symbolism and act which is not limited to Islam, but a kind of act which we can associate with various religious traditions. So we do have as the theme, our Muslims, our brothers and sisters. When we tend to see Muslims presented to us almost exclusively as terrorists, as fanatics, as at least once oil-rich sheikhs, maybe not so rich anymore because of international oil situation. When we tend to see too exclusively, I'm not denying that this isn't part of the truth, but the point is we see it too exclusively, things like an octogenarian ayatollah leading young people to certain death, calling them to certain death in this war that I've alluded to between Iran and Iraq. Or if it's emphasized that the Gaddafi is a Muslim leader, that he's written a green book on Islam, then we find it very difficult to see some other aspects or other sides of what is a very large and complex world of Muslims who accept Islam. My intention, of course, is to rectify some of the distortions, but even with the three sessions, I couldn't do it very fully. I do have some handouts that I'd like you to pick up at the end of the session, and if you intend to go to the other two sessions, to read them. It's a book review that came from the Christian Century on a very important or notorious book by one named Peters. So even if you don't want to come back and you're interested enough, take that review. As I indicated, my intentions are really to try to work with whatever your interests are, even though I may have some basic information that I think is useful and important. Let me just try to take advantage of John Schramm's diagram the other day. It's not possible for me to really fit some of the things that I wanted to say into the form that he had set up for his purposes, but it does have some utility for me. So let's just take the word and say, what would be the major source of the word in Islam for Muslims? Well, that source would be the Quran, or the Quran, spelt in various ways. But it is what, from the Muslim's point of view, is God's word that came through the angel Gabriel to Muhammad, and Muhammad preached it, his followers subsequently wrote it down. When we talk about it, we tend to say that it's what Muhammad said and what his followers wrote down. But from their point of view, it is revelation. It's God's teaching, it's God's will, continuing the revelation that he had already started through Judaism and Christianity, building upon the prophets of those religions, which the Muslims accept. That's the reason or part of the justification for the title of the talk, the children of Abraham, that Abraham and Moses and Jesus are all accepted as
prophets. Jesus Christ is not accepted as a God, but he is accepted as the prophet. So the Quran is the revelation of God spoken or heard by Muhammad through the angel Gabriel and then taught to those who would listen. It's a little bit like some of the expressions in the New Testament. Those who have ears will hear, and but some people don't. They got ears, but they don't hear. So it's to be preached, and then later on it was put into a written form. And its first official written form was quite some time after the death of the prophet. So you might find a kind of parallel there and the Christian scriptures. Right?
Yes. What was the years of Muhammad?
Well, let's just say roughly he's the 7th century. I'll come more specifically to Muhammad in a little while. But here I wanted to try and follow John Tram's formula or model. The Quran is the basic source of the word. That teaching that comes through the Quran is also said to have its special form in the Sharia, which we usually translate as law. And it's also expressed in a special way through the hadith, or the traditions about Muhammad. Another way of trying to get at the word is what we can call Salat in his general way, the prayer. Muslim prayer, I want to emphasize two things at this point. That community or communal prayer is extremely important for the Muslim. But personal prayer is also very important. And so you can have the prayers that you say out in the world, so to speak, with the rest of the Muslims in your community, or with Islam as a worldwide community. And there can be the prayers that you say alone, in solitude. There can be the reading of the Quran personally, where you try to appropriate by yourself, maybe in some tradition of some peer or teacher, but you do it personally. Later on, I'll come back to the idea of Sufism, or what's sometimes called the mystical tradition, or the mystics in Islam. Now, if we move over to the world, we may as well face up to basic categories that the Muslims have. The Muslims traditionally look at the world as being divisible into two groups. What is called Dar al-Islam, that's the place or those parts of the world where the Islamic law, the Sharia, where the rules and the practices of Muslims are dominant or control the community. And in contrast to that, there is Dar al-Harb, or the place where Islam is not free, or where it's under attack, or where it's a minority religion. That kind of categorizing had been very, very important in the past. Today, there are certain Muslim exegetes, sometimes within the Muslim community, they're called reformers, who would try to modify that somehow and not want to have it too stark. But there's no way that we can escape it, it seems to me, that that is a basic way of looking at the world by Muslims. And in Dar al-Harb, it means jihad, the word that you often see in the newspaper. The jihadis or some of the terrorist groups use the word jihad, sometimes it's spelled with an E-J-E-H-A-D. And it means a struggle, to fight. But here again we have an interesting matter, because on the one hand it could be construed exclusively as physical fighting, war. But there are also traditions in Islam, various traditions, which emphasize that jihad is the struggle of the heart. That jihad basically means to overcome evil, even the evil in yourself. So there are, again, many Muslims who want to emphasize that more personalistic, if you like, spiritual dimension of jihad, rather than jihad as a holy war, to spread Islam by the sword, or to advance the interests of Islam as a political religious community in the face of other individuals. Now let me just, while we're at this side, bring up two other categories that are important. Down here I have, in terms of community, that in Islam there is the very pronounced rejection of any distinction between religion, sometimes expressed as a deen in Arabic, on the one hand, and on the other hand, what in the Western world we might consider to be the state, or government, or politics, but also even your personal life. That sometimes it's said that Islam as a social religious system is a namocracy, nomos, law. That it's a system which emphasizes the law, and the law is comprehensive. That comprehensive law making no distinction between church and state, between secular and religious. In some ways, that's quite true. It's much more complicated than that, of course, but again, it's a basic notion that we should recognize. That traditionally, the distinctions between even public and private, and personal and the public, between the state and religion, don't have the recognition or the acceptance in Islamic societies. I recently read an article that reviewed a book where a Muslim argued, well, maybe this was the case in the past, but it doesn't have to be the case anymore. There was a response to that in review, saying, you know, you can't escape it. It's basic. It's not for me to decide how basic it is in terms of the future. It certainly has been basic in the past. So as Islam spread from Arabia through northern Africa and into the Byzantine Empire, into Persia, into other parts of the world, the successor of Muhammad was called the Caliph, C-A-L-I-P-H in English, and that comes from the Arabic word Khalifa, or the successor. And when Muhammad died, having fled from Mecca to Medina because he was persecuted, and then having come back to Mecca and overcome his opponents there, he was a statesman. He was not just the prophet. He was not just the messenger. He was not just someone who had spoken and someone who should be praised as the prophet of God, but someone who had set up a political community. So caliph is a common word among Muslims to indicate a ruler, a person who is the successor of the prophet in terms of both the political and sometimes in terms of the religious. I mean, I should put it the other way. It emphasizes the religious succession as much as the political. But then in practice, the political offices often were differentiated, and the word that we use for that very often is sultan, or the word that Muslims use. So in some cases, the two offices or two functions were combined in one person, the caliph and the sultan. Part of the reason why I'm bringing this up, if you look at Islam as a worldwide phenomenon, and what do I mean by worldwide phenomenon? That means there's no place you can go today without finding Muslims, and you go to some places, they are very clearly the majority. So wherever you go, particularly in those places where Muslims have been the majority, in some parts of Southeast Asia, as well as the Middle East, in some parts of the Soviet Union, the next talk I'm going to say something about the Muslims in the Soviet Union is a very significant minority groups there. A person who leads sometimes might be called a caliph,
He sometimes might be called a sultan. He sometimes might be called a sheikh or a sheik, roughly a chief or a leader, someone who has some kind of authority.
Now I want to move down to John's category of community. From the Muslims' point of view, the Muslims constitute an ummah. Now I know for some people it seems that these Arabic or these technical terms aren't too important. Well, they may not be too important for some of you, but they actually sort of ways to help you remember things, even if you don't remember the word forever and ever. You know that they have a special word in Arabic to indicate the community of Muslims as believers. What is it to be a Muslim? A Muslim is a person that accepts Islam. And what is Islam? Islam means to accept God, to submit to God, to submit to God's will, and to accept the prophethood of Muhammad. Now, it could be very important to emphasize the will part of this, that in contrast to many Western theological developments, where we emphasize both reason and will, the Muslim in the theology, which is often quite in conflict with philosophical traditions in Islam, emphasizes the will of God. You accept the will of God. So the Muslim is the person who accepts that there is but one God, Allah, and by implication, he's accepting the will of a God, and he accepts Muhammad as a prophet. But sociologically, of course, it implies much more. It implies living generally in an ummah. It implies living with other Muslims. It implies, therefore, what we will discuss later, the five pillars of Islam, the common rules and the notions that are accepted by all. In contrast to the ummah, and relatable to the idea of Dar al-Harb, are the dhimmi. The dhimmi. Dhimmi means people who have a certain status under Islamic rule. The people of the book, that is Jews and Christians. They have the Old Testament, the Jews, the Christians have the Old Testament and the New Testament. So they are people of the book. Dhimmis also, in practice, came to include Hindus and other groups, where you had the protection of the Muslim ruler, but you were not to be persecuted. You paid a tax. And depending on how you want to look at it, you couldn't be in the army. That could be a boon or it could be a prejudicial situation for yourself. So the dhimmi often would be organized in what was called the millet system, particularly in the Ottoman Empire. And what that meant was that the non-Muslim in their own group used their own laws, their own personal law, their own religious law, and that their communal life would be protected by the Muslim authority. In this ummah, or Muslim community, there are what traditionally have been called the five pillars of Islam.
Before you get that far, in the ummah, do they wish to be segregated from the others?
The Muslims, do they wish to be segregated?
Yes. Is it important for them to be segregated more than integrated?
Well, ummah often indicated that they were the majority group. Mm-hmm. And often it's really not possible to say in every situation what was the preferred arrangement. But I think we could say that whatever the preferences were, the realities were, in many places,
the segregating. Today we might use a word like ghettoizing, but that's such a loaded word, you see, because if we use a word like ghetto, it carries over all the connotations of the sufferings of Jews. But for those of you who've been to the Holy Land, you know that there are different quarters. Well, just think of that word or that expression, and that might help solve the problem. That by a common consent, by convenience, Armenians would live in one place, Muslims of one persuasion, Shiite would live together, a Sunni would live together, though in some cases they could be mixed. In the Ottoman Empire, for example, you could have a village where the village was split between Muslims and non-Muslims. They would cooperate for certain economic tasks. They would, the village as a sociological unit was integrated economically. It was integrated in some levels sociologically, but in very important ways, of course, it wasn't integrated because all the groups wanted to maintain their own integrity. They didn't want intermarriage. They didn't want to give up their customs. But here again, the variation's so great. If you go to a place like India or Indonesia, often the Muslims, though living separately in a village, participated in the Hindu festivals. The Hindus participated in the Muslim festivals. The Hindus would make pilgrimage to the Muslim places of the holiness, the shrines of the peers or holy men. I think every once in a while, religious leaders, in contrast to political leaders, would be more concerned where the political leader wouldn't be so concerned with religion, but more concerned with stability, with economic problems, with the public order, rather than with an emphasis on purity in the practice of Islam. Is there any other question at this point?
Would they be rejected if they intermarried? If the Ummah would marry?
If a Muslim marries a non-Muslim? Well, it depends on what happens, you see. If you marry someone and your progeny are going to be raised as Muslims, well, that might not be so bad. But if marriage means apostasy or indifference, then of course it will be frowned on. That is currently one of the very contended areas of the Muslims in the United States. That there are increasing numbers of Muslims here, and some of them now have lived for a couple generations. That may be surprising to some of you, just to show you the confusion of things, where would you guess is, at least it's argued, the first mosque in the United States? In what city or what part of the United States would you presume the earliest of the first mosque might be?
New York. Mm-hmm. Washington, D.C.
Well, New York has one of the first, but the argument goes on that it was Cedar Rapids, Iowa, or Detroit. I like to take Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I've gone there and spent a nice few days there. But certainly, it probably can claim for itself the mosque oldest in terms of continuous congregation. The same building hasn't been used. New building has come up. But what I'm trying to get at here is those Muslims as families for quite a few generations now, it goes back to just about the turn of the century, have lived, their children have grown up there, they've gone to the public schools, in some important ways they're integrated into the community, but what's happening to the younger generation there is not dissimilar to what happens to younger generations in some other ethnic communities. Their fathers and their grandfathers wanted to be accepted. So, in terms of my background, the two world wars help, but you don't speak German. Huh?
You might even change the names of the traditional family name. Instead of Herman, it might be something like Terry. So these younger people are often saying, and I have interesting conversations with a couple of them, say people about 26, 27, I say, my father did a disservice to me. He really didn't teach me my prayers. He was really too anxious to be an American. What I'm looking for now, I'm looking for a bride that comes from the Middle East someplace. I don't want some American girl. I don't even want an American Muslim girl, because they too have somehow succumbed to materialism, to the secularism of American society. Now, I'm not saying that everyone thinks that way, but it's pronounced enough that it's discussed and argued among the Muslims in the United States.
Why do they feel such a need to go back to their fraternity?
Well, that's a question that I suppose we could ask about all kinds of groups. You know, why do you feel the need to go back? Well, I think part of it would, for if I could take the young man that I'm thinking of most directly, in his case, it's a feeling that somehow his parents forswore Islam in its fullest dimensions. It's never that they were apostates. They continue to go to this mosque in Cedar Rapids. They continue to raise the children as Muslims. But they didn't sort of show off being a Muslim. Why shouldn't they have been more militant as Muslims? Now, I think that this young man is influenced by these worldwide currents of Islam, where Muslims throughout the world, I'm not saying it's all Muslims again, but numbers of Muslims throughout the world are saying, we've been burying the truth of Islam for so long. Look at the Western world. This is a common Muslim apologetic, if I can put it that way. That's not new. The things that I read today, sometimes in English, sometimes in translations from Arabic and Persian and even Basha Indonesian, go back to the 19th century, where Muslims would say things like, we've known it all along. Why did Muhammad come? Why did God have to send Muhammad? Because the Jews and the Christians screwed things up. That's why Muhammad had to come. He was the last of the prophets. He's the seal. The other prophets had come. God had sort of, you know, started things off the right way, but these people, they just really didn't know how to handle it. They corrupted the tradition. So Muhammad came with a message, and this message is not complicated. It's quite simple from the Muslim's point of view. Lots of commentators say that Islam is basically a fairly simple religion. I often don't know exactly what it means. I can repeat the idea, but the more I know about it, the less simple it gets. But what they mean, I think, are things like, here, the basic teaching. There is but one God. Muhammad, born in Mecca, tells the Meccans, you're a bunch of idol worshippers. You're a bunch of infanticide, you kill your children, your babies. You're materialistic, you're drunk. God wants you to shape up. When he first tells them that, they say, you know, who's this guy? They thought he was mad, let's get rid of him. So in fact, he has to leave, his life's in danger. As he gets more and more revelations. I guess in a sense you could say, the more and more revelation he gets, the more and more God is telling him. You got to tell him more, you got to tell him more, the less they want to hear it. So there is this part of some Muslims understanding their own religion, that people don't want to hear the truth. So Muslims often could say that Muslims were reluctant to tell the people what they had to hear, what they should hear. That's part of what's in my initial prayer. That there are things that all of us should hear that we don't want to hear. The things that I should hear that I don't want to hear. So this young man is saying, my parents gave up that responsibility of being militant in the spreading of Islam. And they should have been doing it in America because America has become so corrupt, so materialistic. But what are the kinds of things that this fellow talked to me about? The movies, the sexuality, the drugs. That's repeated over and over in the Islamic world. That those are basic diseases of the world, which Islam is capable of curing. So the Muslim has a responsibility not to spread Islam militarily, but that doesn't necessarily mean that some of them would exclude it. But the responsibility is like the Christian missionaries in many, many instances. We've got the message, we've got to get it across. And like Christian missionaries, they're becoming much more sophisticated in their missionary enterprises, in terms of publications, in terms of collecting money, in terms of knowing, so to speak, what the other person thinks. So I don't think that it's too unusual from a comparative point of view to see why some people want to go back to their roots or to display, so to speak, their roots and their heritage in a way that they felt their parents had not done, that the parents were fearful. And another aspect, of course, is that many of them are more and more educated, that they feel that they have the capacity to more effectively present the message of Islam than their parents might have been capable of doing. Well, many students of comparative religion want to emphasize that Islam, like Judaism, is a prophetic religion. Maybe unlike Judaism, it's like Christianity in being a missionary religion and religion which sees itself as being universal or universalistic. Though it originates in a tribal society, and though Muhammad's first subjects for preaching, so to speak, are his own people, the Arabs, very quickly it's no longer seen as a tribal religion, but a religion for mankind, for all of humankind. I think that that understanding of what Islam is supposed to be is as important as the very important political drive of Muslims. I'm sort of stepping out of pace, but you know, our time won't last forever, so there's no sense for me to try to go back to all the things I thought I was going to fit in. But I think a basic misconception that we have is that Islam spread throughout so much of the world by the sword. That is a terrible misconception. It spread, one might say, at least heuristically, or get started an argument, it spread no more by the sword than Christianity was spread by the sword. And think of some of our early and famous saints that went into the Germanic lands, or into the Balkan or the Russian lands. That there was a sort of presumption that these people were not only religiously inferior, but kind of culturally and politically inferior. So the imperial dimensions of religion are fairly common, and they're not exclusively of one religion. There may be a few religions that might escape that, but the more I begin to study, I doubt that any of them escape it completely.
I have kind of what I think might be a two-part question, and that is, how do we as Christians view Muhammad? And as you were talking mm-hmm. about Muhammad, he reminded me of Joseph Smith. Is there an equation there where he gets the revelations and then tells these people?
But it's very interesting that you say that, because when I first started studying Islam, that was one of the first things that had occurred to me, that Muhammad's experience was similar to that of Joseph Smith. They're not youngsters. Muhammad is even older than Joseph Smith, when he seems to have had the feeling that God had something special for him. And he removes himself from his successful commercial life at that point, and over a longer period of time than was the case with Joseph Smith, he continues to get the revelation. Now, I'm not sure at all how Christians, either minority or majority, look at Joseph Smith as a prophet. I don't think we've given too much attention to them, by and large. But Christians have given attention to what it means to say that Muhammad is a prophet. An earlier Christian position, going back to the Middle Ages, was no, Muhammad can't be a prophet. The Latin writings argued, or summarized it, Muhammad can't be a prophet because what are the signs of being a prophet? To predict, well, today we hardly ever talk about prophet in prediction, but at least in the medieval documents, it said he didn't predict anything successfully at all. And secondly, no miracles. No miracles. Now today, that's hardly the way we talk about prophets, is it? Even our notion of what it is to be a prophet and prophethood has evolved and changed over time. That'd be one part of the answer. The second one is, whether you accept him as a prophet or not, very much depends on how you view all kinds of things in terms of religion. What's your basic ideas about revelation? If you're at some point on the spectrum of what we loosely might call more fundamental or conservative Christianity, then there is only one revelation. That's the revelation of Jesus Christ. And any other revelation, however good it might be, is only sort of beginning, a kind of preparation. That there's the hidden Christ in Hinduism or the hidden Christ in Islam or whatever it is. And then you move to the further ends where there's belief in multiple revelation, or the whole notion of revelation somehow is put in different kinds of categories. I think whether you want to accept Muhammad as a prophet or not may be tied in with where you see yourself along this continuum. But in terms of our topic, I suppose, whether Muhammad is a prophet or not, whether he is, as earlier Christians often argued, not just the false prophet, but the Antichrist. For a long time, it was a toss-up whether it was the Pope or Muhammad who was the Antichrist. Somebody pointed out to me that very recently, one of the Lutheran synods has declared that the Pope still is to be seen as the Antichrist. And my understanding of the reason for that is not so much to get at the Pope, but to get at the fellow Lutherans who are seen to be too liberal. Well, something like that could go on, I suppose, in terms of your consideration of Islam. But whether Muhammad is a prophet in a very strict sense or in some very loose sense, that wouldn't foreclose or stop, it seems to me, the serious consideration of whether Muslims are our brothers and sisters. It seems to me that from the point of view of the political situation in the United States, they certainly are more and more becoming our fellow citizens. No doubt at all about that.
It sounds to me that the most fundamentalist of fundamentalist type approach is that there's absolutely only one way to live, and that's for them. Anything else is cannot be tolerated.
Well, yes, there are some Muslims that that believe that and act that way. But there are many Muslims, and that's what I would want to emphasize, there are many Muslims who neither believe that nor who behave that. Now, why do I say believe that and sort of emphasize with my tone of voice behave that? Because I think there are many, many Christians who in fact do believe. But really, there is no alternative to Christianity, that ultimately everybody has to be converted to Christ. Now, they might not want to do it with the sword. For various reasons, they might not want to do it with the sword. So why not say that there are many Muslims who don't want to do it with the sword either? But we know that there are many Christians who say, we live in a plural society, that it may be God's wish that at least for a while, that there's a plurality of religions which we have to tolerate. I know there are many Christians that don't accept that. I'm sure there's some here at Holden Hills that wouldn't accept that position. But if they don't accept that position, then they have the problem of how do you behave? How do you behave? How, in fact, you go about presenting your message? You just say what it is that you believe. You make no effort to understand why it is that someone believes what he believes, why he believes a different thing. That's what I mean by, you know, brothers and sisters. That in order to accept or reject them as a brother and a sister, you have to know something about them. Otherwise, you really can't even reject them. It takes more than to say, for someone to say, this is your brother, this is your sister. You have to embrace it. There's some kind of action that's involved. And some people, they act in a very brotherly way without any of the theological, sociological paraphernalia. But there are other people who whose behavior is reinforced. It's more subtle because they know something about those people who, for whatever reason, they would see as their brothers and sisters. Is that another?
Isn't the same thing true with Jews?
Well, I'm not sure I know what the question is.
Well, the same kind of belief, you know, if you aren't of the Jewish religion, you are rejected in the same way.
Yes, I think we can say that's true. There are some religions that are religious-like systems that don't operate the same way or in a similar way to Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Buddhists often operate that way, but that's less and less the case today, it seems to me, if one looks at Sri Lanka or some other places where Buddhism is important to the culture. The once very simple notions we had about Buddhism being tolerant and venerating life have to go by the boards, because modern nation states and the politics of the 20th century will be transformed. You're interacting with those traditional religions in ways that, whatever might have been the case in the past, and those who claim to be Buddhists won't behave the way some of the Buddhists have behaved in the past.
Unitarians, do they accept all religions? Maybe that's a comfortable way to be.
Well, I can't. It's often a difficult question when someone says, you know, what do these people believe? Even for me to be saying what Muslims believe, since I'm not a Muslim. Unitarians do have a position which finds all religions to some degree acceptable. But again, I think the Unitarian has some preferences, as the name indicates, that they may come closer to the Muslim in that they believe that there is one God, and the Muslim says that actually there are only two Unitarian religions, Judaism and Islam, because the Christians are Trinitarian. That's a long-standing argument or polemic often when you want to sort of attack the Christian, or sometimes when people are seriously in dialogue and they really want to pray together, they want to understand each other, the issue of the Trinity does become an important impediment. But there are numbers of religious persuasions or traditions which try to be synthetic or which try to comprehend various religions. Say theosophy, for example. They accept, most theosophies, the organizational theosophy accepts all kinds of religions.